This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The series hasn't lacked hard work or dunks or angry claims of fouls uncalled, but there has been, I fear, a lack of games that could be characterized as close. Game 4 was such a rout that Sunday in Detroit, the Spurs may not want to come out to play Game 5. I'm kidding. They'll come out. But hey, what then? You think the Pistons will feel bad and maybe spot them 10? Joining me now on the line from Detroit to examine the NBA Championship Series in which the Pistons and Spurs are presently tied at 2 games apiece is Michael Rosenberg of the Detroit Free Press. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. And joining me on another line entirely from his office in Traverse City, Michigan, is basketball fan and Only a Game listener Mark Vanderclip, who let Charlie Pierce have it via email this week for dismissing the two teams involved in the 2005 finals. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Now, Mark, in your email to us on Tuesday, you rhetorically ask, isn't it a tad incongruous for a sports writer to discourage folks from watching a major final? It's like a preacher telling someone not to go to church. Why do you differ with those who say that this series is just not worth watching?
Well, it seems to me that even though, you know, everyone's talking about the lack of true basketball stars in this series, you've got a tremendous amount of really technically fantastic basketball being played. I think that the majority of the games that I've been watching have been just beautifully played, and it's great team basketball as far as I'm concerned.
Charlie will have his say about the Spurs-Pistons, about half an hour from now. But do you want to fire another preemptive salvo his way?
I don't have anything bad to say about Charlie. I love his commentary. I think he's hilarious, but I just took exception to what he had to say.
Well, that's far too polite, and I'm afraid we'll have to edit that to make you sound like a rabid maniac.
You want me to try that again?
No, I'm kidding. Michael, what sorts of things are you hearing from detractors of the 2005 NBA Finals?
Well, I think it's a tough situation when you have a blind man perform the national anthem and the nation looks at him and gets jealous. I think that's a bad sign for the popularity of the game. But these two teams must be pretty good if they're still playing, don't you think? I think if people really appreciate the game, they'll watch. I think casual observers won't observe at all, and I think that's why the ratings are kind of like hockey, and not hockey last year, but hockey this year.
Ah, the ratings couldn't be much worse in that respect. Right. Are Pistons fans critical of this series? I guess less critical after the last couple of games.
No, Pistons fans, all Detroit fans just want their team to win. I think when you've got an NFL team that has not won anything of note in 45 years, you'll take what you can get. So, no, they're not complaining the least bit. They don't care if the score is 5-4, which, frankly, it might be tomorrow night.
Michael, you must have access to the players that few others do. Do the players feel that their teams have been unfairly disparaged?
I think the players really just don't care. That seems to be the motto. We like in the media, we like to think that all they do is wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, what did they write about me today? But they figure, hey, they're in the finals, and if we don't like it, tough on us. And I think that's how the fans in Detroit feel. I think the rest of the country looks at them and says, well, we don't like it. Check, please. So.
None of these games has been close. That's one objection. We're talking about scores of 84 to 69, 97 to 76, 96 to 79, and then, of course, on Thursday, 102 to 71. Can one look at these scores and still determine that this is a competition between two evenly matched teams, Mark?
Well, it seems to me like you've got two teams that have just had very good nights at different times, with the series tied 2-2. You've got a very good series and well worth watching as far as I'm concerned. I'm really excited to see what happens in Game 5 because I believe these games are going to get closer and much more competitive as we go along.
Well, that's an interesting prediction. Michael, do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think it's going to be a 60-point game differential, so yeah, I guess it will get closer. It's only got one way to go, but I guess I look at it this way. They've played 4 games, and you don't know who's going to win. I mean, you really don't know. So that's got to count for something, because we've had some series in the past where they played 4 games and it literally was over. And
right, but he's going to the golf course, right?
Yeah, people were already rioting, so we've put that off a little bit, which is nice.
TV ratings for this series are down about 35% over last year's NBA Finals, which featured the Pistons and the Lakers. This drop has been attributed to the absence of Shaq and Kobe, the presence of ABC's new broadcasting team, the later starting times, of course, the Pistons and Spurs styles of play, even been attributed to the NBA's inability to reach a new agreement with the union. Mark, why haven't these factors prevented you from watching?
Well, you know, there was that earlier flap last year with the Pistons and the Pacers in Auburn Hills. I think a lot of people are staying away just because they didn't like the antics of the players, and the Pistons still have somewhat of a black mark on them. But I would watch this final, frankly, no matter who it was. I'm a basketball fan, and if it were Miami and not my Pistons, I'd still be watching.
Michael, it's your job to cover this series, so I can't ask you the same question, but can you really blame NBA fans who just aren't tuning in this time around?
Well, I have a lot of readers who say I'm obviously not watching the games either. I don't blame anybody. I mean, they can do what they want with their free time. I think true basketball fans are watching, but the NBA has told people for 25 years now, stars, 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 stars are what matter. They've marketed. I mean, I don't think people even care what team LeBron James plays for. As long as he's out there, they're going to watch. Mm-hmm. So these teams don't have those kinds of stars. They have a player, Tim Duncan, who's as good as anyone in the world, but he's probably said two interesting things to the media in his life, and that's by design. He just doesn't want the attention. So there's no Shaq, there's no Kobe, there's not a team that runs up and down and gets everyone's attention. It's just good basketball, and let's face it, in an era when you pretty much have to get naked and have rats crawl all over you to get television ratings, good basketball alone is not going to sell.
We're not going to see that in Game 5, are we?
You know, they've actually talked about it with the NBA. They've got Eva Longoria here, so they're halfway there. I don't know how she feels about rats crawling all over her, though.
Game 5 takes place tomorrow night in Detroit. So far, the winner of each game has been the one enjoying home court advantage. Michael, will this pivotal game follow form?
Yes, unless it doesn't. I've given up figuring this out. I picked the Pistons at the beginning of the series, and they just got their butts kicked those first two games, and so I started to waver, and then they've just been dominant the last two. So I would say at this point I'd pick the Pistons to win the series, but that means absolutely nothing, as I'm often told.
Michael, in Game 5 or Game 6 or Game 7, are we ever going to get the highly coveted close game? That's what I want to know.
I think it's a careful what you ask for kind of thing. I think we're going to get a very close game. Unfortunately, it might be 65-63, and I don't think the nation's going to want to watch that either, because these teams have a tendency, when it really comes down to it, to slow things down and grind it out. I don't know if the Pistons can play as well as they did the other night in Game 4. That was almost a perfect display. So I think I'm going to stick with the Pistons, but I'm changing my prediction a little bit. I'm going to go with the Pistons in 13. I think it's going to go that long.
Then it would have returned to Detroit for about the fourth time, and they could win at home.
Absolutely.
Perfect.
We like to bring the media back as much as possible because we know they love visiting Detroit.
Michael Rosenberg is a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. He joined me on the line from Detroit. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
And Mark Vanderklip joined me on the line from Traverse City, Michigan. Happy viewing, Mark.
Thanks, Bill.
At 6-4, the reigning WNBA champions are just the sixth best team in the league this season. But should the Seattle Storm fail to capture their second title in a row, they could always blame the squad of he-hoopsters who helped the she-shooters stay sharp. John Moe reports.
Watching a scrimmage at the training facility of the defending WNBA champion Seattle Storm, you'll see something you might not expect in women's basketball. Guys. At a recent midweek practice, Lauren Jackson, Sue Bird, and the rest of the Storm were squaring off, not against one another, but against a team of men.
We're like crash test dummies.
Mike Dawson organizes the group.
So they can beat on us and beat on us and talk trash to us, and while there's a team waiting on the sideline cheering their own team on. So it's all of them versus us. And we walk out of here, you know, with a workout and helping them out. And we come in here and we sacrifice our bodies for them, so that they can go out fresh.
Dawson has been a player, coach, and general manager of the male practice squad since the Storm was founded. He admires the way these women play.
They're just so smart. I mean, they just know the game. Yeah. You know, I've been playing ball 32 years now, and you know, they know how to use picks. They know how to use the speed. They can use the height. They're just incredibly smart and effective.
Defending league MVP center Lauren Jackson used her skills and height to average 20.5 points per game during the 2004 season. She says the men tailor their style to the women's game.
it's not all athletic and stuff. I mean, sometimes it is, and that's when it gets hard, when they're jumping over our backs and stuff. But it's good for us to get out there and play against them because they are athletic and they are strong, and, you know, not many women are going to be playing like these guys.
According to Storm head coach Ann Donovan, there are numerous advantages to practicing against male players.
I like going against men for a number of reasons. They're quicker, stronger, faster. So it gives us a different athletic look. I feel like if we can be competitive with them at practice, we should be fairly ready for a game. And the second piece is, with only 11 or 12 players on the court when we're healthy, let alone when we have injuries, we can't go against ourselves 5-on-5.
While the men's players won't be on NBA rosters anytime soon, they're not just warm bodies. Guard Greg Hendricks is a veteran of the Continental Basketball Association and other basketball minor leagues and has played in Europe. Hendricks and his practice squad teammates receive game tickets as compensation for their hard work, but he points out there are other benefits.
It's a good workout for guys that who are interested in getting a really good workout, because a lot of times in the summertime, especially towards the beginning of summer, guys go home and, you know, they're not really trying to play. You know, I play overseas. A couple of these guys play overseas or have played overseas, so it's really a good workout. The girls are very competitive. They don't like to lose, so you're going to get a really competitive practicing like a regular practice you would with the guys.
Finding guys who want to be on the team is not a problem. Finding the right guys is a bit trickier. Ann Donovan.
We actually screen who comes in and ask that the guys check their egos at the door, and no unnecessary fouls, or, you know, on a breakaway, let us go. Dunks, we're not encouraging dunks. We're not encouraging individual play. We're asking them to really adjust their game to what we'll see. There's a lot of guys on the list that want to get in, and we're just pretty selective about who we let in.
And once a guy makes the team, it's more than just playing ball, according to Mike Dawson.
Yeah, what we do is we'll just practice against them, doing defense, we'll play offense. But the day before a game, we'll actually run the set plays that the opposing team we're playing against, the Storm's playing against. And, like, our best shooter would be the best shooter on the other team, and I would be the slow white guy, white girl, and, you know, whatever.
So if the Storm repeat as world champions this year, at least some small fraction of the credit will go to the players who pushed them further and helped make them stronger, the men of the WNBA. For Only a Game, I'm John Moe in Seattle.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Rhode Island girls baseball sets its sights on the Olympics. But first, from 1891 through 1918, a shortstop named Huey Jennings set the all-time career record for getting hit by a pitched ball. How exactly Mr. Jennings managed to get hit 287 times has been lost to history. But Don Baylor, the modern record holder at 267, was long suspected of taking one for the team, or taking a great many for the team, actually, on purpose. Houston Astros infielder Craig Biggio's apparently unintentional quest to break that record is covered in exquisite detail on the online blog called Plunk Biggio. And the anonymous author of that blog joins me now by phone. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
I suppose I should call you Mr. X or something like that, but I want to start by asking, why the secrecy? You know, this isn't Watergate we're talking about here.
Well, I really don't have a good reason for the secrecy at this point. At first, I was a little worried that people would take the site the wrong way, so when I was first contacted by some people in the Houston press, I kept my identity out of it just in case, you know, he got hit in the head and everybody blamed me.
Ah, you would be encouraging this.
I'm just hoping he gets the record, and obviously he can't break the record from the disabled list. So I don't want to see him get hurt or anything. I just think it's a pretty interesting record.
Well, on your website, you seem to have broken down every possible statistic related to Biggio's run for the hit-by-pitch record. So what's your best guess as far as when we can see the record broken?
Well, he'll pass Baylor sometime in July, but it's probably going to be sometime next season before he gets past Jennings. So his contract is up at the end of this year, so we have to really hope that he gets re-signed by the Astros.
Or by some team which recognizes the significance of this pursuit.
Right. Yeah. It would be really great to see him finish his career with the Astros, though, because at this point he's been there 18 years, and he's the longest tenured one-team player right now in the league.
I particularly like some of the more esoteric statistics on your site. Here are a few recent gems. Biggio has been hit by seven pitchers whom he once caught early in his career as a catcher. He's been hit 210 times by right-handed pitchers and only 52 times by lefties, and he's never been plunked on June 10th. How do you come up with this stuff?
Well, it's a combination of a database that baseball1.com publishes every year that has year-by-year statistics of everybody who's ever played. And there's a great site called retrosheet.org, which is actually a nonprofit organization, and they're trying to have every box score ever. So there's a couple of great resources.
In 1998, when Sosa and McGuire were going after the single-season home run record, it was breaking news, not only on sports programs, but nightly newscasts, and the newspaper had little boxes so you could follow it. Do you think that Craig Biggio's record attempt will ever enter into the public consciousness that way?
I certainly hope so. I'd love to see it. Maybe ESPN breaking into their coverage to show Biggio's at-bat, you know, either running up to the Baylor record or the Huey Jennings record. Part of the problem is there's so much confusion about the modern record versus the all-time record, but I figure since he can break it, we might as well just shoot for the all-time record.
I think it'll be interesting if this really catches the eye of television producers and newspaper editors to see if it sparks great competition among other major leaguers to increase the number of times they get plunked.
Well, I don't know if I wanted to go that far, but Jason Kendall, currently with the Oakland A's, has something like 180, and he's been getting hit about 19 times a year, so he's on pace to be in the neighborhood of the record by 2010, if he keeps it up.
Finally, at the bottom of your blog, you offer a moral disclaimer. It says, the author of this blog does not support or endorse intentionally throwing at Craig Biggio. But what kind of moral quandary are we in if we root for him to break this record?
Well, I thought about that a lot before I put the blog up. But for one thing, I think that there's a certain purity to the record in that he's not trying to do this, and that it's something that I don't think that he really wants to be hit by a pitch, as opposed to some of the other records that we've seen broken. Like, they say a couple years ago, Brett Favre took a dive so that the guy from the Giants could get the single-season sack record.
I remember, yeah.
Nikisha Sales from UConn going out onto the court in crutches and shooting the basket that put her over the all-time scoring record there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sacrifice that he's doing out there for the team. You know, there's no incentive for him to get hit by a pitch other than that he gets to get onto first base and maybe help him win.
You may be right about that, but there's a little kind of, you know, whispering doubt in my ear that says nobody could get hit by a pitch that often unless he wanted to.
Well, he's even said that if the pitcher comes inside, he's not going to try too hard to get out of the way. But
has Craig Biggio contacted you at all? I mean, he must be aware of this somewhat odd blog.
I haven't seen anything to indicate that he's been aware of it, and he hasn't contacted me. From what I've been told and heard through a couple of other media sources, he's pretty good-natured about it. You know, he seems to have been doing the interviews the past few weeks wherever he's gone.
I should hope so, because otherwise it would be pain with no gain.
Me too. I don't want him showing up here and throwing baseballs at me. Another reason for the anonymity, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, and I'll close by saying our guest is the anonymous author of the Plunk Biggio blog. Mr. X, thank you very much for joining us. I hope we haven't done too much to give your identity away.
Thank you very much.
The only all-girls baseball league in the country has labored in relative anonymity for over three decades. The Slaterettes of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, have been fielding teams for girls aged 6 through 14 since 1973. They added a division for women of all ages 2 years ago. National advocates for women's baseball hope the Slaterettes will provide impetus for the creation of girls' leagues around the country and for the establishment of women's baseball as an official Olympic sport. But 51 years after the only professional women's baseball league folded, progress toward those ends has been slow. Only a game's Martha Biebinger reports.
Haley, keep going. Back up.
Coach Bob Morrill moves the outfield back as 11-year-old Liz Shakunby steps into the batter's box. A handful of parents huddle against the wind on an unusually cold afternoon. Girls waiting to bat teach each other the latest hand slap games, while a few older players look on from the concession stand.
I'm Erin Gerard, and I'm 13 years old. I've been playing since I was four, so 9 years.
Gerard, whose mother was on one of the first Slaterette teams 32 years ago, says the league has a unique place in girls' sports.
Yeah, it definitely does. I feel very lucky that I get to play in this league.
Gerard's sister, 15-year-old Shayna, is on one of five teams in the Slaterette senior division for players 14 years and older. Shayna has been playing for 12 years. She and Aaron chafe when people assume they and their teammates play softball.
First of all, they start off, they're like, oh, it's softball? And we're like, no, it's baseball. We have to explain that it's overhand and we play with a hard ball. They're like, girls play baseball? I think that we should try and get more girls to realize girls can't only play softball, we can play baseball too. So it would be better if we could just get more girls to play.
This year there are 8 Slaterette girls teams in 3 divisions. There's an instructional program for 5- and 6-year-olds. 7- to 9-year-olds play in the minors, and the junior division includes girls age 11 to 13. A group of Pawtucket parents started the Slaterettes in 1973 after one family lost a suit filed against the local Little League for refusing to let girls play. Facing lawsuits in 20 states, Little League agreed to admit girls a year later. 30,000 girls signed up in 1974. Little League does not currently track the number of girls playing on teams around the country. But the Slaterettes player agent, Deb Betancourt, says many girls drop out of Little League.
The girls get a little bit nervous when they're playing with boys, and people just have accepted that that's the way it is.
Betancourt says girls often switch to softball because only girls play, because they don't want to fight to get on boys' baseball teams in high school and college, and because there is a chance for scholarship money later on. But there have been recent efforts to create more options for girls and women who prefer baseball. A group in Fayetteville, North Carolina, hopes to start the second all-girls baseball league in the country next year. The first international tournament for girls' teams is scheduled this October at Disney World in Florida. The American Women's Baseball League has hosted what it calls the Women's World Series for the last 4 years. But there is debate among supporters of women's baseball about whether to build from the top down or from the bottom up. Jim Glennie is president of the American Women's Baseball League.
I've fought with people since 1993 on this. They all said, oh, no, you got to develop the grassroots and this and that. And I said, they'll never play baseball past the youth leagues because there's no place to go. You've got to have that mecca, that dream you wake up with that young boys have.
Glennie's goal is for women's baseball to become an official Olympic sport in time for the 2012 Summer Games. He admits that's optimistic, but last year the International Baseball Federation held its first women's tournament, a precursor to asking the International Olympic Committee to add the sport. In Athens last year, women participated in every sport except boxing and baseball. The American women's softball team won the gold. But without a feeder program for women's baseball, some wonder where the talented women will come from.
The reason the talent isn't there is because, you just don't want to play baseball overnight.
Hall of Fame pitcher Phil Niekro says he has no doubt women can play baseball, but he knows what it's like to try to build a top-notch women's baseball program. He managed the Silver Bullets, a women's team that played men's minor league and semi-pro teams from 1994 to 1997.
Yeah, we were pretty darn good the fourth year. It took us a while. The biggest problem was getting them out of their softball mode. They never threw overhand with the baseball, and they never took windups, never stole bases, and guys are throwing curveballs and sliders and knocking them down at, 85, 90 miles an hour. And, they didn't see those things before.
Niekro says the vast majority of the players were transplants from fast-pitch softball. Today, women's baseball teams, with the exception of the Slaterettes, play by Major League rules.
After the first month of league play, the shine still isn't off these diamond gals.
The 1992 movie, A League of Their Own, is credited with reviving interest in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which folded in 1954. President of the league's Players Association, Dolly Broomfield White, says she's disappointed more women haven't since taken to baseball.
The girls are really pushed into softball. I don't know how many girls that I have met and talked with them and their parents that tell me, well, they wanted to play baseball, but then after Little League, there was no baseball for them. They had to go to softball. I just would like to see the girls that want to play baseball have a chance to play baseball. It's not the same game.
Just off the field in Pawtucket, the Slaterettes' Deb Betancourt says she's trying to help other groups start girls' baseball leagues.
There are probably girls that, given the opportunity elsewhere in the country, would kill to be able to do what these girls are doing right now. We like to say that we were the only league. But I would rather for us to be able to say that we were the first league and have everybody else follow and do what we've done.
Among the challenges will be finding sponsors or other sources of funding.
Strike!
But the Slaterettes say they are proof that baseball is a game for girls and women as much as it is for boys and men. Paula Terrialt is the league's president and plays in the senior division with two of her daughters.
We can play just as well as the men can. You be quiet. Maybe not pitching-wise, but we have arms, we can run, we can slide just like the men can. Some of us maybe even a little better than the men can. We just don't get paid for it.
Terrialt and other women's baseball supporters aren't anxious to see women in the major leagues. They worry that, like the All-American Girls League formed during World War II, women might be marketed more as spectacle than athlete. But they hope, if not expect, that today's T-ball players will have the option of advancing to the Olympics and maybe a professional league. For Only a Game, I'm Martha Biebinger in Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Some girls stay home and let other girls flirt, but some girls need dirt on their skirts. You'll never be alone when you're sliding into home and you're getting some dirt on your skirt. Gotta get some dirt on your skirt.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. Father's Day for some is festooned with ties, turtle wax, and other trinkets of toil, but this spring, writer W.D. Wetherill was thinking about a present from his dad, which, even today, is bearing gifts.
During the hours I spent sitting with my father in his final illness last autumn, I read the sympathetic literature left by the hospice to help family members cope. One of the things I recommended was talking over any unresolved issues while there was still time for healing and forgiveness. My father was too ill for that kind of discussion, and it's a tribute to how close we managed to stay over the years that there weren't any tormenting issues left to resolve. Small issues? Well, that was a different story. I thought of dozens of minor, unsolved mysteries I'd love to get answers to, while the only person who could untangle them was still there to do it. Such as, Dad, why on earth did you go to the sporting goods section of Macy's in the summer of 1963 and, of all the random purchases you could possibly make, buy a 9-foot-long Hedon Mark IV fiberglass fly rod? A purchase that, taken on what could only have been one of the strangest whims you ever had, changed your son's life. I say a whim because Dad had been legally blind since the war. And the only way he managed to fish at all was by my going with him, not only to tie his lures on, but to point him in the right direction to cast the simple push-button spinning outfit that was all he could manage. I'm afraid I didn't do this with much patience. Reel in faster, I would say, after hours went by with no bites. Your retrieve is too wishy-washy. Faster, right, Dad would say softly. Then go on retrieving his jitterbug or hula popper in the same gentle, hopeful way he always did. That was the summer he came to the lake with his new fly rod. And, again, I've spent 40 years wondering why exactly he bought it. I'm not sure he even got around to trying it out before I grabbed the rod, went out to the yard, and tried making the line do more than collapse like al dente spaghetti around my head. But something about the four-count rhythm of fly casting fascinated me immediately. In spin casting, you loaded up the rod quickly with the weight of the lure, then chucked it out there. With fly casting, you loaded the rod in back and forth, ever-increasing increments, building your hoop up slowly before trying it on the water. There were no fly fishing schools in those days, no helpful videos, and I was greatly handicapped by having to learn a skill I had never seen anyone actually perform. But a few days later, by sheer beginner's luck, I hooked my first fly rod fish, a 6-inch perch, just feisty enough to bow the tip of the rod down, make it dance. After 40 seasons of fly fishing, those fish, the bass, the trout, the salmon, even my dad, aren't done tugging on me yet. We live in an age of programming our kids, doing everything we can to map out their futures. We fear mightily the play of chance. I think of this. Try, even now, to find words that would let my father know how grateful I am, not just for all the good things he worked so hard to bring me, but for those lifetime gifts he won me from the random, lucky side of his love. I'm hopeful that somewhere along the way I've managed to do the same with my own 14-year-old son, that he will someday take one of my foolish, inexplicable whims and, through his own passion and dedication, transmute it into a lifetime of joy.
W.D. Wetherill is a writer living in Lyme, New Hampshire. His latest novel is titled A Century of November, published by University of Michigan Press. It's 22 and a half minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a literary and photographic celebration of the Fistic Arts as practiced in various neighborhood gyms. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Speaking of boxing, Mike Tyson imploded in a fight against Kevin McBride last Saturday, after which Tyson said it would probably be his last fight. Where have we heard this before? But can we take him at his word this time?
I think he needs the money so badly, and he's still a freak show. People will sign him up. There were elements of the press conference that differ us from the glory days of, say, James Braddock, who's being idolized in the new Ron Howard movie. It's rare that the winning fighter will point out that the other fighter, quote, bit my nipple.
Yes.
But that's what Kevin McBride said. In the long view of history, Mike Tyson is going to stand as probably the most overrated athlete of the last 30 years. When he was good, he beat no one, and as soon as somebody hit him in the face, his whole career fell apart.
Several listeners wrote this week to take issue with your characterization of the NBA Finals as less than compelling, Charlie. That came when the Spurs were up 1-0, but now that the 2005 NBA Finals are tied at 2 games apiece, have you revised your opinion?
Yes, it's gotten worse.
Oh, dear.
Every game is a blowout. You've got two uninteresting teams. I have a modest proposal for us. Why don't we have a third-place series between Phoenix and Miami? That's one I'll tune in to watch. I want one compelling game out of these two teams where both teams show up and play. And I think the one focus of this particular hash that they're making of the NBA final is the fact that Tim Duncan is one of the strangest superstars in any sport anywhere. Some nights, he's this ferocious, wonderful, hard-bitten, terrifically talented basketball player, and the other nights, he's on the planet Mongo.
The NBA and its union met yesterday in New York, and most people think the lockout, if there is one, will be settled by the time basketball is scheduled to begin again anyway, if not well before that time. So is this really a concern at all?
I think it obviously becomes a concern the longer the lockout goes. Now, if they want to lock them out so none of the players get their free trip to Charleston, South Carolina for summer camp, then I don't have a problem with that. But there seems to be a lot more movement. You know, at this point, for example, the NHL lockout, the season was gone.
That's
and
true.
Everybody knew it.
The Los Angeles Lakers rehired Phil Jackson this week. So will the once and future head coach get the Lakers back into the playoffs using his ability to read the minds of rival coaches and his singular understanding of the I Ching or whatever it is?
His Jedi mind tricks? They'll be a better team. Phil Jackson is a really good coach. They'll make the playoffs. They still don't have the talent to make much noise in the West, but it certainly will be interesting around there. Now, anybody in the world would love to be a fly on the wall in the first, you know, one-on-one conversation between Phil Jackson and Kobe Bryant, whom Phil Jackson called at least a cancer in one of his books.
The Washington Nationals are generating excitement by occupying first place and by catching the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim cheating. On Tuesday, there were so many really cool plot lines running through this story. I can't list them all, but what was your favorite?
Well, I can't imagine that my baseball brethren are not overjoyed to deal with a baseball cheating story that doesn't involve biochemistry in any way. This was a good old pine tar feud, and it was a great old pine tar feud because Frank Robinson, who's going to come out and yell at an umpire 15 months after he's dead, is getting ferocious with not only the umpiring crew, but Mike Socha, the manager of the California Angels.
Ichiro Suzuki rapped out his 1,000th major league hit on Tuesday evening, Charlie. He'd already had well over 1,000 hits in the Japanese league. Should future Hall of Fame voters count what somebody does as a member of the Nippon Ham Fighters, the Kintetsu Buffaloes, and the Chibolati Marines before they make it to the major leagues in this country?
Well, as is always the case, my first option in discussing any Hall of Fame is precluded because I don't have a tack hammer to hit myself over the head with. However, if we are going to discuss this, it's going to have to be, for the time being, what they do in the American major leagues. Otherwise, it's the equivalent of including triple A statistics or slightly above that. It's probably unfair, but and it will probably force Japanese stars to come over here younger. But for the moment, I would think that was the only, that would be the only way to handle it.
The Yankees announced this week that the team plans to build a new $800 million ballpark. This will undoubtedly generate more revenue for the team. Why else would you do such a thing? Do they really need it?
Well, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, is turning into the Johnny Appleseed of new stadiums. He failed miserably in his misguided attempt to get the Olympics by building a stadium on the West Side. He's proposing to build a new one for the Mets out in Queens. And now we've got the Yankees building a new one. The interesting thing, of course, is that the new ballpark's configurations, they lose the Babe Ruth-induced short right field porch. Whatever character the old Yankee Stadium had, which is considerable, will be gone in the new one.
Speaking of investments, the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim recently sold for $75 million, and the St. Louis Blues are on the block. So, P.T. Barnum's axiom lives on.
Well, the Blues always seem to find a buyer. The Mighty Ducks of Anaheim were sold to Henry and Susan Samueli, who I hope their first act will be to unload that god-awful name, the worst franchise name in all of sports. The Blues transaction, of course, comes along with a lease to the downtown arena, which is no longer going to be called the Savas Center because Savas Incorporated has severed their ties with the arena and broke off a lease that was not going to expire until 2020. All of this, of course, is fallout from the very murky and uncertain future of the National Hockey League.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, if you were going to buy a professional sports team, wouldn't you prefer to buy one in a league that was operating?
Well, look what the Savas Company is doing in St. Louis. They're paying $5.5 million. To sever this contract, to get out of a contract in a building whose only major league function is to service the National Hockey League.
In U.S. soccer news, FC Dallas of Major League Soccer proudly announced that their new stadium, which is scheduled to open on August the 6th, will be called Pizza Hut Park. So there's no word yet on whether the best seats will be in the Extra Cheese Club or the Pepperoni Pavilion, but I'm looking forward to seeing
them. They will own my heart forever if in Pizza Hut Park they build the Pizza Park Hut. Where you can buy a hot dog.
If they're listening, if they're listening, they will build it and you and I will come, I'm sure. And finally, Charlie, the Glasgow Rangers, the champions of Scotland's Premier Soccer League, apparently have Sean Connery to thank for the acquisition of the former captain of the Marseille club, Brahim Hemdani. Do you suppose cool secret agent gadgets figured in the negotiations?
I'll play your game, you rogue.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me in the studio each week at this time on Only a Game, unless he's out of town, in which case he joins me by a shoe phone. Thank you, Charlie.
I'll bet you do, you Canadian ponce.
What most people know about boxing is that Muhammad Ali referred to himself as the greatest, that Sylvester Stallone made an excellent living pretending to be a heavyweight named Rocky, and that there have been a lot of ads recently for Cinderella Man. But as a new book entitled Shadow Boxers makes evident, the real heart of the sport is not in the movies or on television, but in the small gyms where boxing is taught and practiced. Joining me now from the studios of KOPB in Portland, Oregon, is Jim Lamason, who took the photographs featured in Shadow Boxers. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
And by Jim's side in the studio is Catherine Dunn, who contributed two of the essays in the book. Catherine, it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
Talking about photographs on the radio is a risky business, but I want to run that risk on behalf of the color shot on page 53. It features a young female boxer with an expression that is decidedly unfierce and her father, who's wearing a These Colors Don't Run sweatshirt. Jim, tell me a little bit about these two, please.
This was a photograph I took in Lowell, Massachusetts, and we watched this woman hit the heavy bag. Like, I've never seen anybody hit a heavy bag. She basically knocked the padding out of the bag, and she is a ferocious fighter, and her father basically has nurtured her through boxing, and I think she does look rather intimidating because basically I saw her beat the crap out of a bag and is a very strong fighter.
Catherine, in an essay entitled School of Hard Knocks, you write of the gym that, quote, for many, it's the safest place they know. Could you elaborate a little on that contention?
I think that Jim, in the process of his creation of these photographs, traveled from coast to coast, literally, to hundreds of boxing gyms. And most of them are found in the very roughest, worst neighborhoods in inner city areas. They are, in Jim's own words, sometimes the only living place for many blocks around. That's the place where you really see that this is in and of itself a culture. This is a place where people are taught and nurtured and protected and supported. It's a place where you kind of automatically know that you're tough enough if you walk through the door. So you earn the right to be kind. And kindness is one of the most consistent elements that you see in operation in a boxing gym.
Jim, defenders of boxing have long maintained that the sport gives a kid with nothing a chance to succeed and make a living, maybe even win a championship if he's one of the very fortunate few. What percentage of the people in gyms these days are there to learn how to make a living?
You know, I think most people, when they walk into the gym, they have that in mind. And, you know, not many people get there, but along the way, there's a whole lot of lessons that one learns. And as most of us at one point in our lives have had somebody who took us seriously, and whether it's a teacher, a scout troop leader, or a boxing coach, that one person allows you to reinvent yourself, and then you can go forward with that strength.
I think that's really true. And I would suggest that there actually are a fair number of people who come into the gym who don't actually have that I'm going to be the best, I'm going to be the champion attitude. I think a fair number come in because of something immediate in their lives, that they want to defend themselves against the neighborhood bully, or they want to flex a muscle that doesn't make them too flabby. And I think a lot of times they just want to get some self-respect. But it's true that whether they ever become really successful, either as amateurs or as pros, if they are trying, it changes their lives. To seriously train as a boxer, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't eat Twinkies. You get the right amount of sleep at night. You get up and run every morning. I mean, this is serious business.
And beyond all that, you become a part of a very specific community.
Very true. Yeah. Very true. A community that really values those clean living, seriously ethical attitudes.
Given the near certainty of physical damage, I don't subscribe to the idea that boxing is a great way to get ahead, but I love the language of the sport. One of the men teaching boxing in Oakland, a gym in Oakland, says of the youngsters in his gym, quote, "If they leave here in a couple of years and rob a bank, at least they didn't rob it while they were here." Does that seem to you, Catherine, about the right level of optimism as far as reclaiming kids through boxing?
You know, there's a boxing gym here in Portland that's been in operation since 1951. It's called the Knott Street Boxing Club. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, they had a celebration in memorial for the former boxers from that club who had died. And some of them had been shot by the police, and some of them had died of drug overdoses, and some of them were in prison, and some of them had died of malnutrition lying behind a dumpster in an alley. But what's interesting to me was that the people who were there celebrating were counselors, psychologists, college professors, real estate developers, a restaurateur, a man who owns a trucking company. There are people of all walks of life, many of them very, very successful. And so I think that anything that can be done to give a kid a chance is a chance. That's all.
Catherine, you mentioned boxing has produced a lot of terrific writing. You mentioned Homer and Norman Mailer. I would put Bill Hines and A.J. Liebling and maybe Joyce Carol Oates on that list as well. What is the nature of the appeal of the sport to a writer?
Well, you know, it's a sport that is so completely human and exposed as human. It's like a Zen painting, maybe. You know, it's always the same in one way. It's always a white-lit ring with two guys or two humans as naked as prime time allows. And their will and their ability and their strength pitted against each other. And ideally, they are equal in weight and equal in experience. And so it comes down to an issue of character. And I think that there's something so fundamentally dramatic about that and so revealing of human identity that it's a natural for writers, just like it's a natural for people to either be compelled or repelled by it. Mm. It's very powerful. It's drama.
And Jim, does a photographer have the same attraction? Is it the simplicity of the drama, the starkness of the drama that is the same secret to the appeal for a photographer?
Well, I think so. And, you know, for me, it really was kind of about the journey of, you know, thinking that I was going to document one thing and then realize something else. And when I realized that something else, and it really is what the gyms are about, was when we were in Philadelphia photographing one of the toughest gyms in America. And when we got there, here was one of the greatest trainers of all time working with a 9-year-old kid, giving this 9-year-old kid as much attention as he is to the contenders who were waiting their turn. You know, so it really was more of a sociological thing for me. It wasn't visual. It wasn't political. And, you know, I have no interest in romanticizing boxing or demonizing boxing. What I found was in the gym, and that's what intrigued me, and that's what Shadow Boxers is about for me.
Jim Lamason took the photographs for Shadow Boxers, subtitled Sweat, Sacrifice, and the Will to Survive in American Boxing Gyms, published by Stone Creek Publications. He and Catherine Dunn, who wrote two of the essays in the book, joined me from the studios of KOPB in Portland, Oregon. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And Catherine, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help from Stephen Cray at Oregon Public Broadcasting and from Vince Fairchild. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view some of Jim Lamason's photos from Shadow Boxers, browse Only a Game show archive, or perhaps sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from former Big League knuckleballer and Colorado Silver Bullets coach Phil Niekro, who makes the case for female baseball players by citing family history.
My sister could have been a very good baseball player, I think. She used to catch my knuckleball in the backyard.
Right you are, Phil. And these days, a good knuckleball catcher probably commands an annual salary which amounts to more than what you earned in your entire career, which started in 1964 and lasted until 1987. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.